Okay, so thanks to the organizers for setting up this meeting. So I'll be talking about topological defects or dislocations in these topological insulators with strong spin orbit interactions. So this work was done with a beginning grad student, Frank Zhang, and with Ying Ran, who's here, who's really been the, the driving force behind this project. Okay, so the idea is very simple. It's described in this paper on the this preprint on the archive. But let me sort of say a few words of introduction to set this in perspective. So we're going to be interested in insulators which have some exotic band topology. Okay, and the, one way in which you can sort of identify these insulators is by looking at the surface or the edge. So quantum Hall effect, you've got a chiral edge. This quantum spin Hall effect, you have this so-called helical edge, counterpropagating edge states. But as Kane and Millie pointed out, they're stable, although they're counterpropagating, they're stable as long as you have time reversal symmetry. Okay, and similarly, in the three-dimensional version of this, there are unusual surface states that you have. Okay, so there's a very analogous phenomenon in superconductors. So formally, if you have a superconductor that's completely gapped, it's in many ways like an insulator. They're both described by quadratic Hamiltonians. They're completely gapped. And again, you can have some exotic band topology. For example, you have this P plus IP superconductors or some of these exotic paired states of helium-3. And again, you can tell that they're exotic by looking at the edge or looking at the surface. Okay, but we know actually for superconductors, there's a different way of identifying this unusual band topology, and that's by looking at topological defects. Okay, so a superconductor is a broken symmetry state. There's an order parameter, superfluid. So at the very least, you have this phase order parameter. And you can create a texture in that phase order parameter that's topologically protected. That's this vortex. And if you create a vortex in a PX plus IPY superconductor, spinless PX plus IPY superconductor, then it, you find that it actually traps Majorana mode. Similarly, if you have a vortex loop in the B phase of helium-3, you are propagating Majorana modes along that vortex loop. Okay, now you have this as long as you have this exotic band topology. And also another condition you need is that, for example, over here, you need an odd strength vortex. Okay, that's when you get this unusual states in the vortex core. Okay, so an alternate way of diagnosing exotic band topology in superconductors is by looking at textures of the order parameter. Okay, so you can ask, this is a question we asked. So crystalline solid is also a broken symmetry state. In principle, you can also have topological defects in a crystalline solid. So if I look at, for example, these topological insulators and insert a topological defect in the crystalline solid, is there any analog of this sort of physics? Okay, so the sort of simple conclusion we came to, a simplified summary of our conclusions, is that the answer is yes. If you look at the topological defects of a solid, the simplest kind are called dislocations, and they host these protected propagating modes along the dislocation. So the dislocation is a line in three dimensions. So these lines will host these propagating one-dimensional modes, and in terms of the mode counting, it's exactly like the edge of the two-dimensional quantum spin Hall effect. Okay, it's got one right mover, if you like, and one left mover, and they're protected. They can't scatter from, they can't backscatter as long as you have time reversal symmetry. Okay, so if you like, this is a way of realizing sort of an ideal quantum wire. So if you had low temperatures and the only kind of scattering you have is elastic scattering, by inserting a dislocation into this three-dimensional topological insulator, topological band insulator, you can create this ideal quantum wire. Okay, now one thing that's been left out over here is the analog of the condition that you had over here, that it's the odd strength vortex that carries these modes. Okay, so I'll develop that as I go along. There's some analog to that over here, but this is sort of the simplified summary. Okay, so the plan is the following. I'll tell you a little bit about the classification of these topological insulators. You probably know a lot about this already. You'll hear more about this in the following talk, so I'll keep this very brief. I'll spend a little bit more time in talking about dislocations. So someone like myself, I knew a lot more about topological insulators than dislocations when I started this project. So I'll go over that with you, and then I'll put this together to figure out the condition under which you have these protected modes. Okay, so I'll focus on these three-dimensional topological band insulators. So as discussed in these papers, most of the authors are in the audience, Joel and Leon, Charlie Kane and Raoul Roy. The conclusion was that you can classify these insulators with strong, with spin orbit scattering, but which retain time reversal symmetry by these four binary numbers, right? Four Z2 numbers. Okay, so the first number, let's call it nu zero. It can either be zero or one. The interpretation of this one is very simple. Okay, so we'll call the zero one, following convention, the weak, and the one, the strong topological band insulator. Okay, now there are this remaining set of numbers that are somewhat neglected usually. They'll turn out to play an important role in this talk. These numbers are actually defined with respect to a certain basis of reciprocal lattice vectors. Okay. So you've got to pick a certain basis. So we're talking about a crystalline system. You can go to Fourier space, reciprocal space, pick a basis for that reciprocal lattice vectors. And once you pick a basis, you can figure out what these numbers are. Okay, and actually, the way we like to describe this invariant is to take the inner product between these two sets and take half of that value. Okay, so if I just form this combination over here, that's some reciprocal lattice vector. And half of that is actually a momentum that's invariant under time reversal. Okay, so you take this momentum to minus of itself, they're actually the same momentum because they're connected by a reciprocal lattice vector. Okay, so the two facets of classifying these topological band insulators, there's this weak versus strong index, and then there's this time reversal invariant momentum. Okay, this explicitly refers to the crystalline lattice. This doesn't. Okay, so what's the if you're given a band structure, there's a formula by which you can just calculate these. Okay, in fact, if it's inversion symmetric, there's a very simple formula to calculate these things. Okay, but let me give you the physical interpretation of these indices. The first one is quite easy to interpret. So if you have the strong topological insulator, if you make a surface of this material, what you find is that there are an odd number of Dirac points on that surface Brillouin zone. Okay, so that's what this index does for you. And what the other index does, this thing related to the crystalline symmetry, the crystalline lattice, is that it essentially fixes the location of these Dirac nodes in the surface Brillouin zone. Okay, so where they land in the surface Brillouin zone. Okay, so they have to appear at some time reversal invariant momenta. In the simplest interpretation, what you do is you take this particular vector, you project it onto the surface Brillouin zone. Where it lands is where the single Dirac node will appear.
So if nu zero is one, that's the strong topological.
That's strong, yeah.
And then you need one of the nu one, nu two, or nu threes to be non-zero.
Is that? You don't.
No, they could all be zero.
They could all be zero.
This m vector could be zero.
Yeah. So in which case it'll always land at the gamma point.
Okay.
So if they're all zero, if nu zero is zero and nu one, nu two, and nu three are zero two, that's a trivial insulator.
If nu zero is one and all the others are zero.
Okay, so then it's a strong topological insulator. So let's look at this table. Don't look at this. Right, look at this one. It tells you where, so then there's a single Dirac node. That's how I want to characterize it. Take a surface, there's a single Dirac node. It's a question of where the Dirac node lands.
So it's not a decoupled layer.
It's not a decoupled layer. So that's a, so the thing about the strong topological insulator is it isn't adiabatically connected to some decoupled two-dimensional problem. It's intrinsically a three-dimensional state. Okay, whereas if you have nu zero equal to zero, what's called this weak topological insulator, the way I want to think about it is that you can adiabatically connect it to a system which has decoupled quantum spin-all layers, and the stacking of these layers is along this m nu direction. Okay, so if you have layers of a crystal, you can specify the stacking by terms of a reciprocal lattice vector. So take twice of this if you like. That's the stacking direction.
What is the direction if all of them are zero?
It's a trivial insulator. So that's the that case you don't have anything special. Okay, so now to talk about dislocations. So let me imagine I have a three-dimensional solid. Turns out you can have line defects in this three-dimensional solid, and they're going to be characterized by two things, just like a vortex. You can, if you're more comfortable with vortices, you can just think about vortices. So just like a vortex, it has the location of the center I can draw by this red line. So it has some, there's a line inside this three-dimensional solid. It has some direction as well, if you like. That's where this the defect is, the core of the defect lives. And then there's also an analog of vortex charge, which is called this Burgers vector, P. Okay, so one formal way of deriving that. So what is the order parameter of a crystal? So if you're given a piece of the crystal, you can compare it against a reference perfect crystal, which has locations of the atoms at these locations. And I can put that into correspondence with the crystal I have by some displacement vector. Okay, so the order parameter of a crystal is really this displacement vector. Okay, now clearly this displacement vector is ambiguous by basis vectors of this crystalline lattice. So you've got to keep that in mind. It's not single value, this order parameter, just like the phase of a superfluid. Okay, now as I go around this this defect, what can happen is that as I adiabatically follow this curve, I end up going through some non-single valued path in this order parameter space, but then this integral has to be quantized to the units of the ambiguity over here, which is really lattice vectors. Okay, so these defects are quantized to lattice vectors, which is this Burgers vector. Okay, so that's really how you define a dislocation in a solid. There's this line, and then there's a charge, if you like, which is this Burgers vector. Okay, so it's like a vortex charge, except that it has three integer components in a three-dimensional solid. And just like a vortex charge, you can't change the Burgers vector as you go around along the defect. It stays fixed. Orientation of the defect can change. Okay, so a little bit of, a few more pictures. Ashcroft and Merman has all these pictures. So one way of creating a defect, a dislocation, is, let's say I want a dislocation along this red line. I take a plane that ends in this red line. Okay, I can take actually any plane I like, as long as the boundary is this red line. And then I displace, all the crystal on one side of this plane by the lattice vector that I'm interested in, okay, by the Burgers vector. Okay, and then you glue everything back because you've displaced it by a lattice vector. When you glue things back, everything fits perfectly except along the center of this defect. Okay, that's where you have some singularity. Everywhere else, it looks locally like a crystal. Okay, so this way of doing it, where the Burgers vector is parallel to the dislocation line, this is really the simplest kind of dislocation. Okay, it's called a screw dislocation. Essentially, what happens is that the lattice planes, which were stuck like this before, now once you displace them and stick them back, you have sort of a spiral staircase. As you go along a lattice plane, you keep climbing into the next layer. Okay, and in this process, you really don't have to add any atoms or subtract any atoms. Okay, another kind of dislocation is where this Burgers vector is perpendicular to the dislocation line. Okay, so you cut it and then you shift. And in this process, you have to add some atoms or subtract some atoms. You have to add a plane of atoms, as you can see over here. That's an edge dislocation. Okay, so in general, a dislocation is neither screw nor edge-like. As the dislocation loop moves around, it's sometimes parallel to the Burgers vector, sometimes it's perpendicular, sometimes it's mixed. Okay, but these are limiting cases which are easy to figure out. Okay, so the last thing I want to tell you about dislocations is that it's actually hard to get rid of them in a solid. They're always there. Okay, they're there at fairly high densities. They're responsible for, the plastic flow of solids. That's a cartoon of how your solid flows. It's like a caterpillar moving. There's a dislocation that moves through the solid. And in fact, when you grow a film of a system, of a, you know, this thin film, we have growing materials, the way it grows is actually through this sort of screw dislocations. So atoms really like to sit where there are many neighbors, so you end up propagating a screw. That's the most efficient way of growing a solid. Okay, so now let me tell you about what happens when you take this screw dislocation, when you take a dislocation and put it inside this topological band insulator. Okay, so the central result, which I'll prove in a minute, or at least I'll give you some plausibility argument. So let's say you have a dislocation which is characterized by a Burgess vector B and some location for its center, and you embed it in a topological insulator which is characterized by these indices. The condition that you need to examine is the inner product of this Burgess vector B and the time reversal invariant momentum, m nu. Okay, now, if this was a reciprocal lattice vector, the product of these two has to be a multiple of 2 pi. Right? Now, since this is half of a reciprocal lattice vector, this product is either 0 or pi mod 2 pi. Okay, now, if this inner product is pi mod 2 pi, then the claim is that you'll have these protected one-dimensional modes inside the dislocation core. Okay, but if this inner product is 0, modulo 2 pi, you don't. Okay. Okay, so let me again sort of reiterate what the properties of these modes are. So if I think of momentum along the dislocation line as being a conserved quantum number, this is what the energy spectrum would look like. In the absence of the dislocation, you have a completely gapped system. When you put in the dislocation with the right Burgess vector, which satisfies this condition, then you get a pair of one-dimensional modes that go from the bottom to the top of this band gap. Okay? So one is a right mover, one is a left mover. It's not possible for these modes to backscatter and open a gap as long as you have time reversal symmetry. Okay, so if you have non-magnetic disorder, you essentially have no scattering, just like at the edge of a quantum spinall state. Okay, so one thing to notice about this formula is that it doesn't care whether you have a weak or a strong topological insulator. It's insensitive to the nu zero index, which may not be that surprising. You know, the dislocation is a property of the crystal, so you might expect that the indices that refer to the crystal are the ones that know about the dislocation. But anyway, okay, it doesn't care whether it's weak or strong. And also, there are some topological insulators which never have helical modes on their dislocations. Okay, so take the pure strong topological insulator, where which people pointed out, if m nu is zero and this is a strong topological insulator, so you can make any dislocation you want, it doesn't carry these modes. Okay, so really we are sensitive to this other index, this weak index.
So suppose we have this weak topological insulator, which is but this defect line means that perpendicular to the layer line.
Okay, I'll come to that. It's a good question. I'll come to that.
That result, m nu equal to zero, not having any dislocation helical modes, that's somewhat surprising because this definition of m nu itself is somewhat ambiguous.
I mean, it's not ambiguous. If you have a perfect crystal, it's not ambiguous.
I mean, if you change your basis, or if you change your origin and k-space from 0, 0, 0 to pi, 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 then the m nu changes. Basically.
You can add a reciprocal lattice vector to it.
If you redefine the unit cell, then it changes.
Yeah, so you can add any reciprocal lattice vector to it. So m nu plus g, right? That's the ambiguity.
Yeah.
But that doesn't affect this condition. Okay, so so just to sort of give you one demonstration of this. So we did a numerical study. You can also prove this directly, but let me just show you as a simpler to be, should just show you the evidence and later give you some plausibility arguments. We used this toy model that Charlie Kane and collaborators introduced. Take the diamond lattice with nearest neighbor hoppings, second neighbor spin orbit induced hoppings. Make one of the bonds either weaker or stronger than the others. You can end up with a topological band insulator. Let's say you make it stronger, you end up with a topological band insulator with these indices. Okay. Now, the easiest dislocation to introduce in a tight binding model, this actually came as a surprise to me, but Ying seemed to know it just off the bat, is that it's very easy to introduce a screw dislocation into a system if you have a tight binding model. Okay, so the idea is the following. How long do I have? Am I out of time already? Or?
Yes. 20 minutes really.
So I'm minus two, or?
How long do you still need? Say something that finishes the talk.
Maybe another 5 minutes.
Okay.
So 5 minutes from now, so. okay, so all the bonds that are cut by this cutting plane, you just add a phase factor to them, which is depending on the momentum that they carry, the momentum that you're solving for along this direction, you just hit it with this phase factor, k times the Burgers vector. Okay, that's how you introduce the screw dislocation. It's very easy to do. Since we're looking at something topological, if you prove it for a screw dislocation, you proved it for all dislocations. Okay, it's just dependent on the Burgers vector. Okay, and as you can see, you solve for the spectrum. Without a dislocation, it's completely gapped. With a dislocation, you have these pair of modes that cross the energy gap. And we put in two dislocations for obvious reasons to get periodic boundary conditions. The wave functions of these modes are peaked along the dislocations. Okay, actually four modes over here. They're lying right on top of each other. One pair for one dislocation, another pair for another dislocation. Okay, so the most general proof of this I can give later if someone is interested, but there's a sort of simple pictorial proof of this for the weak topological insulator. Okay, the general proof of this is less pictorial, but it doesn't depend on whether it's weak or strong. Okay, so you know, I've already said that I can adiabatically connect my weak topological insulator to a stack of decoupled two-dimensional quantum spinel layers. Okay, and the stacking is along this direction, okay, mu. Okay, so how do I create a screw dislocation over here? I take the set of stacked layers. I adiabatically deform a Hamiltonian so it's all decoupled layers. So each layer is completely gapped, right? So now I cut, I make a cut through the sheaf of layers. And when I cut them, I expose these edge states. Okay, so I've only shown one of the pair of edge states. There's a right mover and a left mover in each edge. Okay, so now what I do is I shift everything by one lattice spacing and then I glue it back. Okay, to create a unit screw dislocation. Okay, so that's shown over here. I glue this top guy with the bottom guy and so on. And in this gluing process, the edge modes get gapped, right, when you glue them back together, except for the top layer and the bottom layer. Okay, so there the edge modes, you know, they don't have a partner. They're still running along. Now, these edge modes can't stop. And the surface is gapped. They've got to go somewhere. So they have to be going through the dislocation and coming out on the other side. Okay, so that sort of is a pictorial way of seeing why, at least for this particular geometry, you get this.
Wouldn't it even easier for an edge dislocation?
Okay, you can.
If you have an edge dislocation, mm-hmm. then you just have one layer that ends.
Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so, well, there's an experimental candidate apparently for the strong topological insulator, but what I want to point out, it also has a non-trivial M mu. Okay, so, in principle, dislocations over here should, you know, carry these, the right dislocation will carry these modes.
You mentioned before that this M mu was related to the location.
Yeah.
The direct points. Okay, there are five, so how should I think?
Well, you know, there's one that's important, right? The rest of them, you can annihilate them in pairs and get rid of them. So there's 1 plus 4.
I understand. There's no sense in which you can say which of the 5 is the one.
No, there is. Okay, so, I mean, you can be a little more precise. I've, you know, made a very kind of simple story about this being the location of the single Dirac node on the surface. So, you know, if you want the full story, it's there in Charlie Kane's most recent paper.
Is that if you look at the 111 surface, at the 1-1 surface of bismuth antimony, which has its M vector pointing in the 111 direction, then the point which has the Dirac point is the gamma point. And so the statement is that either the Fermi energy encloses the Dirac point at the gamma point, or it encloses Dirac points at the other three points. It's one of those two. You can't say which one it is, but it's either the gamma point or the other three. And then the other surfaces, there'd be stuff going on at the other points because of the M vector. But since the M is pointing along 111, that picks out gamma on the surface.
Yeah.
So why this kind of is a wire, it's an infinite line,
can be a loop.
A series of small loops by some disorder, can some perturbation turn this straight line into some circulating loop and finally can be rolled away. Is that possible?
No.
No.
So it's I mean, you can have loops of this, you know, so this could be a dislocation loop, and this loop you can shrink to zero. But if you have some, you know, a loop that goes from the bottom to the top, you want to shrink this to zero, you've got to find a partner, right? It's exactly like a vortex. Just think of a vortex.
Why is this in a weak topological? So in the layer, you have even numbers, and it's equivalent to have even chain.
Yeah, actually, I have something to say about that, so let me get to that. In the next minute. So there are various, you know, consequences of experiments which I can talk about if people ask. Probably the easiest is to look for it in STM. There's a question now about disorder, and I think this is something that's interesting for discussion. The general impression is that, you know, very reasonable kind of conclusion was drawn that if you have disorder on this weak topological insulator, it's unstable. Again, the reason is the surface states are not stable if you add disorder. It's got an even number of Dirac nodes on the surface. And, you know, it's quite plausible that, you know, the state itself is disappears with very small amount of disorder. Okay, but here we have a different way of characterizing the unusual band topology of the weak insulator. Take a perfectly clean crystal, then of course nobody doubts you have this weak topological insulator. Create a single dislocation in this crystal. It has these propagating modes. And now introduce a little bit of disorder, but don't introduce dislocations. You just introduce some weak disorder that doesn't mess up the crystal. Okay, and then you expect that this propagating mode survives. Okay, so essentially the point seems to be that if you have very strong disorder where these dislocations proliferate, then there are other gapless modes into which your the defect can tunnel into and, you know, disappear. The modes on your defect can disappear. But if indeed you preserve the bulk gap and you have a single dislocation, if dislocations are well defined, which is possible in a disordered solid, then it appears that there is, the weirdness of this insulator is still preserved, even though the surface states are not present. Again, it would be nice to sort of make this sharper. I'm not quite sure how to make it sharper, you know, partly because it's not very clear how you characterize a given solid, right? It's some non-equilibrium. You're just given a certain collection of atoms at certain positions. If you had something like, solids that were optimizing their position in respect to some external potential, then you can talk about the statistics of getting these defects and so on.
What if your disorder stays in the gap, in the bulk? Would that...
If you have extended states, it would destroy it. But if you have localized states, you don't expect it to destroy it. So the lowest energy guys, if you want them to leak out, they've got to be some extended states in which they can leak out.
What happens if you go into a glass phase and you do so little by these dislocations that you lose the order?
Yeah, then it's dead. You can also get a...
There could be a critical point there, or... You can ask about the electrical conduction.
Yeah.
When you kind of write out that critical point.
Yeah, yeah. So it's some statistics, right? It's when you say it's riddled with dislocations, there's some statistics question over there.
I'm a little confused. If I have dislocations of finite length and there's some mini gap,
yeah,
it's not truly gapless, so it's
a
bit like some other localized state.
Yeah.
So you expect something in the statistics of localized states that would tell you the difference between...
No, take an infinitely large line, right?
But would I expect to have infinitely long dislocations?
No, put in one dislocation.
No, it's certainly well-defined if you have an infinitely long dislocation.
Right.
But in this question where you're given a chunk of material with mm-hmm. some finite dislocation density, and certainly if you can inspect one dislocation, that's great, confirmed it. But macroscopically, if all the dislocations have finite length, is gapless mode sort of a...
Okay, I wouldn't argue that way. What I want to do is I want to make a diagnostic of the unusual band structure. So my diagnostic is I will insert a dislocation. Now, if all the other dislocations that you spontaneously generate are small, they can't kill the mode along this dislocation.
And a related question. So if you have two dislocations which are finite, but they are linked, mm-hmm. then you will get real zero.
Okay, we can talk about this. So if you have a single loop over here, there's a zero energy state.
A single loop?
Yeah. It's not shifted. I know what you're thinking about. It's not like that.
Suppose you have now one very long line. So I cast this crystal into many, many different small pieces. So this line became disconnected with the other
If you have a line, it ends on the surface, you know, it opens out on the surface, right?
So I can cut your this the solid dimension into small pieces is kind of effect of this order. So I think when this kind of things can turn out this long connected line into small disconnected loops.
That's related to this question that if they are decoupled quantum string Hall layers, do you still have?
Yeah, okay. I don't think I understand how you're bringing disorder into this cutting. Maybe we can talk about it later.
So this current has to be finally need to connect it from a loop, right?
No, it can end on the surface. So the surface is gapless states. So this, so it turns out there's a very nice consistency condition. Every time you have a dislocation which carries this mode, it has to terminate on a surface that has some gapless states. So for the weak topological insulators, some surfaces don't have gapless states.
The charge should be conserved.
Yeah.
You cannot have a purely source and a drain.
Well, it's, you know, there are counter-propagating modes. So in equilibrium, there's nothing, there's no current running, right? If you add an electron to that in the right mover, let's say, then you get a current.
I just want to make sure I get some of the things that are correct. So a single isolated loop has a zero mode, which is protected?
It has a propagating...
The energy of it is just...
It goes down to zero, yeah. So it looks like this. So it's an infinite line, right? So you can parameterize it by the momentum along that.
What about usually a finite loop?
A finite loop, well, okay, so... It's not zero energy, it's the quantization condition.
Oh, okay.
So you'll have a mode at exactly at pi, you know, with a... Okay, so sometimes you spontaneously get this anti-periodic boundary conditions. For example, take the edge of a PX plus high PY superconductor. You know, you might think that if I have an edge of, you know, some length, I'll have momenta 2 pi over L times an integer. But it turns out it's 2 pi over L times, you know, N plus a half. You get an extra Berry's phase, you know, for quasi-particles at the edge of a PX plus high PY. Okay, so that if...
If you have a vortex, you know, then you get an exact zero mode.
If you have a vortex, so it's related to this fact, actually.
But that's protected because you have the superconductivity, so zero energy is special.
Yeah.
Here, zero energy isn't special.
It isn't, yeah, of course.
Or is it a half integer?
Yeah, there is some... You know, so we thought maybe the weak and strong are different because it could have that as a difference, but they don't. I mean, they'll... But you know, that's just, yeah. Anyway.
I mean, if you have two dislocation loops near each other, you can get a tunneling between them. Or
yeah, you can. Yeah, right. With the you know, there's a cutoff which is the inverse of the band gap.
There's an idea of special meaning to zero energy.
Yeah, there is.
That's
right. Yeah.
If you have a dislocation, do you have any in the 2D?
Yeah, there is. We can talk about it. There's something analogous you can write down. Yeah, but it's not a propagating mode, of course. It's a, you know, a state.
Because in 2D we don't have weak Z2, so it seems we shouldn't expect any.
You have only one Z2, but it's not so simple, right? It's you can have, you do have some effect at dislocations. Okay, so... okay, let me just end. So this is the formula that I wanted to point out, and future directions. So I think one interesting direction, which I can, if anyone's interested, so you know, there are proposals for doing quantum computing with non-abelians in these superconductor, you know, proximity induced states. So there's something analogous you can propose for these dislocations. And interaction effects, I think, would be interesting. If you have, you know, you have the Coulomb interaction that's present, you can kind of estimate how big they are in these systems. It's possible they might be important. So the velocities tend to be small, dielectric constants tend to be large. But, you know, if you're in the right regime, it could lead to interesting Luttinger liquid-like physics. Okay. Yeah, so let me end there.
So I guess we already had a number of questions. We should just move on.
There seemed to be one question there. Or
so if you had a lattice of dislocation loops with random tunneling between them, I mean, it seems like there's some sort of three-dimensional analog of the Trouble-Covington network model, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
If you still have long-range crystalline order loops that are finite.
transition?
Yeah, mm-hmm. If you have an infinite density of loops, or small loops.
Well, maybe that's just the 3D isolation.
Yeah, you know, one idea we had was if you look at the conductivity of this bismuth antimony, it's much larger than you would expect from surface conduction. So we thought maybe the dislocations are playing a role, giving you extra conduction. But it turns out that you make a rough estimate, it's even larger than that. So it's not dislocations alone that are, you know, there's a fairly believable story that there are these impurity states in bismuth antimony that, you know, give you large conduction. It's actually a fairly good metal at low temperatures. Look at the conductivity. The insulator, the topological insulator, is a fairly good metal.
Can you get more than two moles? I mean, one probably this way, the other probably that way. Or it's always just one mole?
If you get more, they're not topologically protected. They could be there for momentum conservation reasons or something. But you know, you can have backscattering then. That's like a regular quantum wire. Four modes with time reversal symmetry. That's what you'd expect in a quantum wire. And that will be susceptible to Anderson localization. So here, yeah.
So in the diamonds, you were just getting just one and one?
One and one, yeah.
So what about the experiment you wanted to show to pretty much look at this system?
Okay, yeah. So so one is electrical conductivity. There's some excess conductivity you'd expect. If you can orient your dislocations properly, you would, you know, for example, if in film growth, apparently you get screw dislocations. So then if you do conduction along the axis of the screw dislocations, you'll have an excess conductivity. That's roughly the number you'd expect. It's actually an overestimate. The other is to look at scanning tunneling microscopy. So if you're at the Dirac point on the surface, you've got zero density of states. So that's the ideal setting for looking at this. But because you have one-dimensional modes, they have a finite density of states. Right, and if you're at a dislocation. So if you go to the at the surface where this dislocation opens up, if you do STM, you'll have a finite density of states if you're exactly on top of a dislocation, and zero if you're away. And you can compare two cases, one with a dislocation with the right Burgers vector, the other one with the wrong Burgers vector. And you'll see in one case you have the density of states, the other one you don't. So, you know, a priori they're no different, but one has got the right condition. Actually, maybe,
If you shear it to induce some plastic flow, then there are these things called fraying resources that can spill out dislocations.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You might expect some time-dependent
conductivity. Yeah.
That theory also applies to three-dimensional layer of the quantum Hall system.
That's right, yeah.
Then you have, say, like this one-dimensional line, and you end up with the boundary. Then you see there's a charge current, so how can it be? The charge is not right.
Okay, that's a good question. So, you know, if you have a surface, right, let's say you have two dislocations that terminate on the surface. Take two screw dislocations that terminate on the surface. They're actually connected, you know, by a ledge. So you can just draw it and you'll see there's a ledge that connects them. So it goes up, it runs along the ledge and comes back down.
We only have one line?
No, you'll always have a partner somewhere. If it's it depends on the kind of dislocation you're talking about, but for a screw dislocation, there'll be a partner where it comes back down.
Okay, maybe we should thank Ashwin.
So if you go back to the slide, you just go ahead and take. Are we recording this?
Yeah.
Okay, so this talk is going to be a lot like the last one in spirit, where what we've learned about topological insulators tells us something about basic old-school condensed matter physics. In that talk, it was dislocations, and in this talk, it will be the polarizability tensor, not just of topological insulators, but of all insulators. The second part will be, how does that help us when we think about defining the topological insulating phase and calculating whether an interacting material is in that phase? And then I have one slide at the end related to what Carlo Bienacker talked about. Let me thank especially the younger people involved in this work, current students Andrew Essen and Vasudha Shivamoggi, and also David Vanderbilt, Ying Ran, who's here, and Xiaogang Wen. All right, so I took seriously the idea that we should say a little bit about other people's work and how things fit together. So the basic outline of the first part of the talk is to very quickly review what Charlie Kane talked about, which is this recent work over the last few years on these Z2 invariants in two-dimensional and three-dimensional materials, starting from a band structure or pumping kind of picture. Then I'll give a little bit of prehistory about how people came close to understanding the 3D topological insulator back in the 80s, although they didn't realize that's what they were talking about. Essentially, Wilczek and others worked out what if you had a so-called theta term, what would the physical consequences be, but they had no understanding of the microscopics, really. And then a more mathematical group of people worked on, are there topological invariants of things like band structures related to the second Chern class rather than the first Chern class? Then what was a big part of our inspiration was a quite beautiful paper from earlier this year by the Stanford group, which is what Xucheng talked about on Monday, that really tied all these things together and explained that what seemed like different things are in fact closely connected. And then what I'm going to talk about is sort of inspired partly by that. We give sort of a more condensed matter-y derivation of the result and explain what it teaches us about ordinary insulators, A, and B, some experiments that people have done. So first, the lightning introduction for people who weren't here on Monday to topological insulators. In 2D, there's one Z2 invariant, if we restrict for the moment to perfect crystals. That's the distinction between ordinary insulators and quantum spin Hall insulators. When you go up to 3D, at least in a perfect crystal, there are four Z2 invariants, but one of them is stable to strong disorder. The others are probably not, and I'm going to focus on the strong topological insulator. So let me give our picture. As was said before, there were three papers with slightly different ways of looking at the problem, but I think we all agree on the answers for this, and I'm going to talk about the picture that Leon and I had. So the idea is going to be to understand the three-dimensional topological insulator, building from what Kane and Millay taught us about the two-dimensional quantum spin Hall effect. So what came as a surprise to us was that if you try and do that with the integer quantum Hall effect, there isn't really any truly three-dimensional integer quantum Hall effect. There are layered versions of the 2D problem. If you layer the quantum spin Hall effect, that gives you three weak topological insulators, but it doesn't give you the strong one. The way to get the strong one is quite interesting. In particular, you can't get it if you don't mix up and down spin. That is, if you have separate up spins and separate down spins, you can realize the two-dimensional quantum spin Hall effect, but you can't realize the 3D topological insulator. So our picture was the following. We know that in two dimensions, if I've got a two-dimensional time-reversal invariant band structure, then really the fundamental object is sort of half the Brillouin zone. And with a bit of work, I can define a Z2 invariant for any of this two-dimensional band structure kind of problem. Now let's go up to 3D. In 3D, if I have a time-reversal invariant problem, topologically the Brillouin zone is a cube. And in that cube, there are six independent planes that look just like the 2D case. So for example, if I look at planes perpendicular to the Z direction, XY planes, there's something special about the KZ equal to zero plane and about the KZ equal to pi over A plane, which is actually the same as the minus pi over A plane. What's special about those planes is that they're taken to themselves under time reversal invariance. If I took some arbitrary plane in the middle, time reversal invariance would reflect that down somewhere in the bottom, and it's not a constraint. Now, the way to build the three-dimensional topological insulator is to remember what we know about 2D, which is that in 2D, I can connect the ordinary and topological insulators without closing the gap as long as I'm allowed to break time reversal, because only Chern number survives then, and Chern number is just zero. So what I do is take a two-dimensional ordinary insulator, say, break time reversal as I move up in the z direction and get to a 2D topological insulator. And that will realize the three-dimensional strong topological insulator. So you might wonder, well, I just said there are six planes. I can define a Z2 invariant for each of the six planes. Doesn't that mean there are six invariants? Well, the only heavy lifting in our approach is to show that there are two identities that reduce the number of independent invariants from six to four. But I do think that, at least definitely for inversion symmetric materials and presumably for all materials, this is equivalent to what was done in the other papers by Fouquet and Millet and Roy. Very quickly, the surface consequences, which are the easiest ones to see in experiment, although I'll be talking essentially about another set of experimental consequences of the strong topological insulator that don't have to do with the surface bend structure, is that there's a surface, Fermi surface, that encloses an odd number of Dirac points. That's only possible because I'm looking at one surface. If I looked at both surfaces together, both top and bottom, then I would need to enclose an even number. There's only one spin state at every k, so this is sort of a picture of what the band structure might look like.
You don't mean boundary chiral fermion, right? You mean boundary Dirac.
Did I call it chiral?
Okay.
Yeah, oops, sorry. You're right. And then, once again, this is the experiment. So bismuth antimony was proposed by the Penn group and does seem to work. And just to say very quickly, bismuth is a very interesting semi-metal. You put in 10% antimony, and transport data down here shows that it starts to become insulating. At least the resistivity is blowing up. I don't know what happens at the very lowest temperatures. I was told that it actually saturates, which is bad, by someone here. And anyway, this is the surface. As you can see, the surface band structure is actually quite complicated, and it would be really wonderful if the materials that Professor Zhang talked about will realize this phase and have simpler surface band structures. Okay, so now let me give a essentially completely different picture of what is the three-dimensional topological insulator. So imagine that I consider the effects of a theta E dot B term, and the units that I'm choosing this coefficient is E squared over H on electrodynamics. So this very nice old Wilczek paper talks about what are some of the consequences of that. The angle turns out to be periodic. There were papers sort of trying to realize this type of physics, but they didn't understand basically the even odd effect that we have understood in the last few years. So just to be clear about how this is mathematical or topological, this is called the second Chern invariant of the EM fields, which are abelian. It's going to turn out that this second Chern invariant of the EM fields is related to second Chern invariants of the electrons themselves. So there's a very nice connection. In the same way that the Chern-Simons theory of EM fields and the quantum Hall effect is related to Chern number of the electrons. So the physical consequences that Wilczek talked about, and there are some additional consequences discussed by Professor Zhang, I won't go into this, but basically all of these have to do with the existence of surface quantum Hall layers with an arbitrary fraction of E squared over H. So again, if I have a boundary where theta jumps, that's really the only easy way to detect this, because this term is a total derivative. When theta jumps, I get this Chern-Simons layer, which corresponds to a sigma xy related to the change in this theta angle. So what's different between this and our previous picture was that if I have a time reversal invariant system, since I can't get from 0 to pi, which correspond to ordinary and topological insulators, I have to break time reversal if I want to open a gap. That is, I have to break time reversal to get from 0 to pi, which means I open up a gap. If I don't break time reversal, then it's gapless. Okay, so what motivated us was first to try and see if these currents are here, and then understand for a general insulator how could you practically compute the result of this Chi, Hughes, and Zhang paper. So this is the physical picture of what I was talking about. So suppose you have a slab of a three-dimensional strong topological insulator. There's a top surface which has theta over 2 pi times E squared over H. There's a bottom surface which has minus theta over pi E squared over H. And I can always add, if I want, integer quantum Hall layers down here, up here. It's going to turn out that there's a very close analogy between this and the theory of polarization, where I add surface charge layers rather than surface integer quantum Hall layers. Okay, so how does this connect? How do we connect the two pictures? So, for example, Fu and Kane had pointed out the existence of these half-integer quantum Hall layers, starting from the idea that there are an odd number of Dirac fermions at the boundary, and we know that an odd number of Dirac fermions will give you this kind of sigma xy. So the connection is odd number of Dirac fermions corresponds to half integer. And are those half integer layers really there and physical? And more generally, for arbitrary theta, how could we see them? That was what got us interested. Then very quickly, something that has to do with the mathematical classification subject of this morning that I'll say a few words about again later on is where does the second churn come from in a band structure? So forgetting about EM fields, if I'm actually just thinking about electronic problems, fermions with periodic parameters, why should second churn number be important? Well, the oldest case I know where people had talked about it is that if I have a so-called quaternionic problem, which basically would correspond to a band structure where at every k I have a time reversal invariant Hamiltonian, so at every k I have Cramer's pairs, then that actually has no churn number because of the time reversal invariance, but it does have a non-trivial pi 4. It's got something like a four-dimensional quantum Hall effect, and there's a paper on that by Zhang and Hu in Science. So this problem is very much analogous to the 2D integer quantum Hall effect, and it's really the source of the topological insulator which survives even if you don't have this perfect symmetry. But there are still important differences between second churn and first churn that I'm going to come back to later. So many of you have seen this talk before, therefore you've seen this joke before, therefore I won't make it, but time's changing. Well, no. Times change. So the new thing is that we have the odd-even effect of time reversal invariant fermions. So how can, and now I'm going to essentially re-derive the main result of the Chi, Hughes, and Zhang paper in a slightly different way that doesn't require any field theory. How can we understand the connection between axion electrodynamics, which is this theta term, and electrons, say, in a band structure? So the key formula we want to get to is this one, because this is the connection between microscopic Berry phases, these A's. So for example, we know that polarization, churn number, lots of interesting things come from the Berry phases of a band structure. In this case, if you integrate the so-called Chern-Simons form, you get theta, which is a macroscopic electrodynamic observable. The second churn number actually came up having nothing to do with topological insulators, but when these authors, New and others, we're trying to compute what is just the polarization in a crystal if the crystal isn't totally uniform. And it turns out that you can use that, where the second churn form also appears, to give a different derivation of this formula. Very quickly, and I should say, I'm going to mention a little bit how this Chern-Simons integral appears in a different kind of system, and someone I would acknowledge personally, the first person to explain to me the relevance of second churn number was Andre Bernevig. So the basic idea is that if you want to understand what theta is in a solid, so you'd like to know, is there this particular topological coupling between E and B? It's basically just the orbital magnetoelectric polarizability. And the good news is, this is an old-fashioned condensed matter quantity that people have actually looked for experimentally, and even found. So theta is determined by either the change in orbital magnetic moment with respect to an applied E field, or the change in electric polarization with respect to an applied B field. And if your conventions are different from mine, you can stick in some minus signs, but that's the basic idea. And that this theta we're going to rederive is given by this formula. So the reason that's true is that an orbital magnetic field, what we call orbital magnetic polarizability is what they call magnetoelectric polarization. The only difference is that it's been measured, it's part of the polarizability tensor, and that kind of opens up a new class of experiments one could try to do on topological insulators. So for example, one experimental reference that I came across where people had actually measured theta, so essentially they knew that theta was topological or related to axions and so on, but they didn't realize that it had a topological origin in terms of the electrons. In this case, it's not arising from orbital motion, it's arising just because this is a antiferromagnet that breaks inversion symmetry. It has theta, which, if I did the conversion right, is something like pi over 25. They applied a magnetic field and they measured some buildup of surface charge. The nice thing.
This material breaks T in the bulk.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So if I had either inversion or time reversal, theta would be fixed to zero or pi. But here it isn't. However, this is maybe less interesting and doesn't have anything to do with microscopic second churn class because it isn't orbital. It's actually motion of the ions. But the good news is that it does seem that people can measure theta. So very quickly, what we actually did for a calculation was take the Fouquet-Mallet model and add a term to let us interpolate between 0 and pi by breaking time reversal. So if you want to know what this corresponds to in Dirac mass, here it is. But essentially what we're going to show is that a bunch of different things are tied together and are all exactly the same in this model. One is the existence of surface quantum Hall layers, which is what leads to the experimental signatures that Wilczek and Zhang et al. Talked about. And then we would like to say that without actually having to put a surface on, we can compute everything just from bulk properties by studying this magnetoelectric polarizability. So first, in order to see that there are surface layers, you know that a whole slab will have an integer Chern number, but you can resolve where are the contributions to that Chern number coming from as I move through the slab. And this is basically saying that there's a half integer at the top, there's a half integer at the bottom, and I can switch that half integer by applying some local T-breaking field. So indeed, there are half integer layers, and just by resolving the Chern number in real space, you can see them. And how did we understand why this is a bulk property and it's actually totally independent of the surface? Well, the claim is that you can apply a weak magnetic field and think of that as a crystalline inhomogeneity. That is, really, instead of thinking of it as an applied field, you think of it as you're slightly changing the properties of the band structure as you move along. And then this formula from the Shao et al. Paper directly tells you that theta is just the integral of the Chern-Simons form. If you wanted a dual derivation, instead of computing the polarization in the B field, you could compute the magnetization in an E field, and you'll get the same answer. So now, to do some bulk calculations and show that they all agree, we computed, just using the standard polarization method of King-Smith and Vanderbilt, that it matches the Chern-Simons integral. So the idea is if I take a supercell, I can put an orbital flux through it, see the response. And the great thing about that is it generalizes directly to the interacting system. Okay, so finally, to show that we did some actual work, this is showing that the four different ways we could come up with to compute this theta angle, some of which involve a surface, some of which don't, they all agree all the way from 0 to pi in the parameter of the model, which corresponds to 0 to pi in terms of theta. So magnetoelectric polarizability is indeed both second churn of the electrons and second churn of the fields. And if you're interested in polarization, there's actually a very close connection between everything about this magnetoelectric polarizability and what we know about polarization in 1D, which is just the integral of A. In particular, the one thing I would point out that in hindsight should have been a clue that magnetoelectric polarizability would be a neat thing to calculate. In polarization, there's a quantum of polarization. So that is, if you give me a bulk crystal, I can't tell you what the absolute polarization is, because you're free to add one integer charge per transverse area at the boundary. So it's got a non-universal quantum. While this magnetoelectric polarizability, the quantum is just E squared over H. And the reason why that's true is this transverse area that appears in the polarization quantum is also the quantum of magnetic flux. So even if P has a non-universal quantum, the ratio P over B has a universal quantum, which is just E squared over H. And there are various other similarities that I won't go into. So the last thing I want to say, let me skip over this, is maybe a little bit about where does theta come from? Because to me, this is the biggest difference between this magnetoelectric polarizability, which is pretty complex, and ordinary electrical polarization. Electrical polarization is essentially a simple sum of bands. There's no interesting interaction between bands. That's not quite true for this magnetoelectric polarizability. So for example, if I take any model with just one occupied band in a two-band band structure, I'll actually find that theta is equal to zero. More precisely, if I've got one band that doesn't touch any other bands anywhere in the Brillouin zone, I believe that I'll always get no interesting magnetoelectric polarizability. So it's something about interaction between bands that is the physical origin of this effect. Okay, so the last thing I want to say on this topic is getting back to the classification idea. What do we learn about interacting systems? So the good news is that this theta term, E dot B, is certainly a well-defined object, whether we're talking about interacting or non-interacting systems. So macroscopically, it's obvious what the generalization is. You still look for theta. But how do we compute from the microscopics what theta should be? I suspect that the second Chern number does not actually generalize, basically because if I just have one many-body wave function and try to compute the second Chern number from that, I don't have any symplectic structure left, and I think I'll just get zero, but I'm not absolutely 100% sure of that. What does generalize directly is this magnetoelectric polarizability. In other words, if you want to define what is a three-dimensional topological insulator, here's an operational definition. You give me a black box, I apply a physical magnetic field through the box, not a boundary twist, and I measure the polarization. If the polarization responds, that's a topological insulator. And then a different definition will be talked about by Sung-Sik, I think. There's one thing I wanted to say about how this connects to previous definitions of the Z2 invariant. So I do think we had operational definitions of the phase with interactions even before all this recent stuff, but there was something that came up yesterday in Xiao Liang's talk where he was criticized a bit, and I actually think he's right, so I wanted to quickly say in the spin charge context what I think is going on. So I think, first of all, the right way to define pumping for the Z2 invariant, and let me focus on 2D because that's what was discussed yesterday, is first you insert a pi flux. So that's a physical change in the system, but the point is this is not a 2-pi flux. There is some physical change because I've done this, and if I want to close the cycle, I need to find some way to get back from pi to 0 that is a different change in the system, and the second part should actually not break time reversal. So that is, there's a 2-part cycle. Part 1 breaks time reversal. Part 2 doesn't break time reversal. And this is exactly the sort of new Thouless and Wu version of the Fu-Kain formula. So we gave sort of a independent geometric derivation of that formula. It basically says there's one part, which is integral of f over half the Brillouin zone, which is exactly this, and there's a second part, which is related to the boundaries of half the Brillouin zone, and that's exactly this. Now, in Xiao Liang's talk, and we can prove that it's possible to close the cycle in any non-interacting system, as Xiao Liang said, you can view this first part as inserting a charge flux, and the second part as inserting a spin flux. Now, the one problem with inserting a spin flux, as he said, is that you don't have a guarantee that the gap doesn't close, but if the gap doesn't close, then this is a well-defined thing, and the amount of charge you pump in this whole cycle, whether it's even or odd, is exactly the Z2 invariant. So, in other words, it's non-universal whether you pump the charge here or you pump the charge there, but the total amount of charge you pump is either even or odd, and this is just the sort of physical meaning of the Fu-Kain formula, I would say. So finally, what I would say as far as what we'd like to learn about interacting systems and about generalizing this theta response. First, one big subject of this morning, there are a lot of other topological insulators. In particular, work by Kataev and work by Schneider et al. Gives a very beautiful picture of what are the possibilities, especially in three dimensions. Are there response functions like the polarizability that will diagnose those? I think that would be very nice in helping us know if they generalize to interacting systems. I didn't talk about orbital magnetization in response to E-field, but that's probably a better response to compute if you have time reversal invariance. Finally, something that experimentalists are very interested in is in E cross B responses rather than E dot B responses, which are called ferrotoroidic. There are a lot of experiments. There is at least one theory paper claiming that they're topological. I don't totally understand that theory paper, but if it's right, then that would be quite interesting. And then finally, you can make theta dynamical, and then you have real axions. And this is just a one-slide advertisement, and then I'm done. So related to what Professor Bienacker talked about, change gears. Think about Majorana fermions. In particular, think about if you've got a superconductor ferromagnetic junction, then it was shown by Kataev and Fu and Kain, that you trap a Majorana fermion here. If you make a chain of these, then something very interesting happens. So the picture is just throw down some glop on your sample, which separates into random superconducting and ferromagnetic regions. At every boundary, there's a Majorana on top of a topological insulator edge. At every boundary, there's a Majorana fermion. If these regions are large, then there's no tunneling, and the Hamiltonian is just zero. The thing is that the leading tunneling that you include gives you the random Majorana hopping chain, which maps into the random quantumizing model, and that has some nice features. It's basically the C equal to 1/2 version of the particle hole symmetric Dirac fermion chain, which Belenson, Fisher, and many other people have studied. The reason why I think this kind of random hopping problem is interesting theoretically is that we know how to analyze this using strong disorder real space renormalization group. And the reason why I think this is possible to do experimentally, there's a clear signature of what you'll get if you can get to this quantum critical delocalization point. You will get a peak in the tunneling conductance through this whole thing. Basically, there becomes one extended state at zero energy that lives through the whole random Majorana chain. So I think I've probably used up my time, and that's it.
going back to the beginning of the talk, can you explain some more how you get down from six invariants to four?
Sure.
This all is not invariant.
It's a little tricky. The idea, as I said, it's the only heavy lifting. So you're asking me about the one thing that I said was boring and technical. Maybe more of it's boring and technical, but at least the one thing that I admit is boring and technical. If you take one quarter of the Brillouin zone, so not one eighth, but one quarter. So what I'm going to do is show how you would prove one of these equalities. The idea is basically to take one quarter, which is something that's periodic in one direction and has one boundary, which would be, say, I guess x equal to 0, x equal to pi, one boundary which will be y equal to 0, y equal to pi, then the statement that this product is equal to that product basically comes from looking at the flow of Chern number either into or out of this box as I go around and saying that the Chern number is sort of conserved and is either flowing in through this boundary or that boundary, and the relationship between how it flows in one boundary and how it flows in the other boundary turns out to be exactly this. So that's the sort of sketch. It's an integral. Okay, so if you like, the reason why half the Brillouin zone is important, the integral of f, okay, what appears in that Fukan formula is integral of f over the bulk and a over the boundary. A over the boundary is actually reflecting sort of on this side, how much Chern number is flowing in or out. So that's the basic idea. I won't try to do the integral in detail, but it's taking one quarter of the Brillouin zone and thinking about what's happening to the Fukan formula in that one quarter.
So some part of my talk will be devoted to that.
I would like to ask about bulk properties versus surface property. You said that you can define the theta from this, the magnetic electric polar or otherwise, but it seems to me that it can only be measured when there is a change of that quantity in space. If all the space is filled with theta material, and there is no way to measure.
I agree that's true. But what I would say is that if I have it, it's very much like ordinary polarization. If I have ordinary polarization in bulk, I don't think there's any easy way to measure it. If I put a boundary on, then even the polarization itself is not well defined, but the fractional part in units of some quantum is well defined. So that's saying here, if I have a boundary between theta and zero, then, but anyway, if the basic point is that I need a boundary to actually measure it, then I agree with that.
Yeah, so we don't know that our vacuum isn't theta equals pi.
David told me that there's an experiment.
I see. So the question is whether should I interchange 0 and pi? Okay, I thought that they were indistinguishable, but if there is an experiment, then that's good.
Yeah, well, heavy problems.
No, there are not. I mean, you know, it's a question of whether, can we transcend the question of whether there's a minus sign in the mass of quarks?
So you can tell without a boundary.
But do you need Wicking fractions? Can you tell purely fast time fractions?
There are quark masses in the real world. Is the question about the real world?
Yes.
Yeah. The question is, how do we know that we're in theta equal to zero?
I think theta equals pi just doesn't work.
Yeah, it's not theta, not measuring.
How do you relate it to the existence of monopoles? Because physically, the way you measure theta is how you put between the charge and the monopole.
There are other effects of theta measure. I mean, it changes the dynamics of the bulk locally.
Yeah, but I mean, in this theory, it allows monopoles, and it should be measured. It doesn't.
Or
it
is. Which are, in a sense, monopoles. So the the dynamics is totally different.
But I think just using the electron, I can't see any way to measure bulk theta.
That's reasonable because if you don't have monopoles, then the theta term of U1 is always zero. I mean, it requires the compactness, and compactness leads to the monopole. So it's reasonable that you use the monopoles.
Yeah, but in QCD,
you have.
But the
trivial insulator, you're saying that we cannot figure out the theta equals to zero there?
What I'm saying is that if you're restricted to just the electron, can you tell the difference between zero and pi? You can certainly say that at about, I mean, this is perhaps some fairly philosophical debate from the point of view of condensed matter, whether we live in a theta equal to zero world and topological insulators are theta equal to pi or vice versa. But I think for almost all the likely experimental signatures will show up at the boundary. I'm content to say that. So what you can tell is if there's a boundary between type A and type B, and which one is zero and which one is pi. I think you can diagnose in principle, but I don't think there's going to be a standard condensed matter experiment to do it anytime soon. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but that's my...
As we discussed, those things are topologically distinct if you have a boundary.
Yeah, well, once you fix a boundary, it's like with polarization. I mean, once you fix a boundary, then you've specified a particular amount of integer quantum Hall layers that you've added. So the fractional part is universal and determined by the bulk, but there's an ambiguity by some quantum, and that quantum is just adding integer quantum Hall layers or not. So the same way polarization is universal in the bulk, in its fractional part, but you can add surface charge layers, and that will modify it. It's pretty much something I found very helpful. So David Vanderbilt is sort of an expert on polarization, and almost everything about this magnetoelectric polarizability is a very nice higher-dimensional generalization of polarization where all the non-universal numbers drop out. That's sort of how I'd put the surprise to me.
But in a real system, what would be the surface Hall conductivity measured? I understand it's big yourself to
a... Do you mean if I open a gap?
Yeah.
Yeah. In this case, I mean, that's right. If we put a local field, I mean, if you are willing to accept this, I don't see anything in principle unrealistic about the Foucault-Millay-Hamiltonian. So if we open a surface gap on this, we get a half. E squared over 2h.
Why half and not 3/2?
Because we have only one Dirac fermion in this model, and we applied a weak field. And we didn't add additional...
It's a matter of details of the model.
Exactly. So whether you get 1/2, 3/2, or 5/2... So, for example, in this case, what we did to get from this curve to that curve was leave the bulk exactly the same and only change the details of the surface. And that basically whether we break time reversal one way at the surface or the other. And that jumped from 1/2 in the surface layer to -1/2 in the surface layer. If we'd modified again only the surface, not the bulk, by just gluing on an integer quantum Hall sample, then this would have gone up to 3/2 or 5/2 and so on. But with only one Dirac fermion, it would be pretty unnatural to get something other than 1/2 or -1/2. It would. You mean that if I'm well away from the Dirac point, so I've got a high electron surface density, and then, yeah.
You move the Fermi energy and you can go through Landau.
That's right. If you move the Fermi energy away from the Dirac cone, then you'll fill more Landau levels and you'll get some arbitrary. I mean, this is actually a big problem with bismuth antimony. It has a high electron surface density, so for reasonable fields, you're likely to have a large occupied number of Landau levels.
So one small question about this calculation. So you are introducing anti-ferromagnetic neural vector into this Zeeman lattice model.
That's right, a staggered Zeeman field.
There are three directions, but there seems only one available mass, which is time reversal odd. I mean, the neural vector is a vector, but there is only one available mass, which is a gamma fiber mass. So you have two directions of neural vector, which doesn't open gap.
I haven't thought about it in detail, but I can believe that. But if we just select an arbitrary direction for the field, unless we happen to have one component, unless we have the interesting component zero, it will tend to open up a gap. So not opening up a gap would be fine-tuned. Right.
Any ideas on what the response to, what would be the interesting E dot E cross B response?
Well, people actually see it. In fact, there is a conference here at KITP on moments and multiplets and Mott materials and so on, and this ferritoidic stuff was discussed there. Basically, E cross B is a pointing vector. So you see a difference between light going one way and light going the other way. So it's not only fairly easy to detect, but it might actually be useful. And in some of these materials, they see these ferritoroidic domains, which are basically parts where K is preferred for light and parts where minus K is preferred for light. The problem is I sort of begin to suspect that E dot B is a much more topological thing than E cross B. But this PRL claims that's not true, so we'll see.
I'm sort of, I think it's probably a dumb question, but I'm just confused. So what keeps talking about the theta term as being related to some quantum Hall effect. But, and so if I just take CR203, which is some magnetic insulator.
That there it's not. So,
I apply electric field, there's supposed to be a Hall effect at the surface.
No. Basically, you just have an anti-ferromagnet. When you apply an electric field, the ions shift a bit, and that gives you a bulk magnetic moment that isn't orbital. So that's saying that not every theta has to correspond to these quantum Hall layers at the surface.
As a current on the surface, but as a confined current, it never goes.
Yeah, you could think of it as some kind of displacement or confined current at the surface. But I think the standard physical picture of what's going on in this CR203 would be that.
Could you? I mean, the current for the neurals for the 1/2 that you get is also. It's not a transport current in the sense that you can't measure it with.
Okay. Okay. Let me put it this way. I would say to me.
You could measure it with by measuring the. Magnetic field.
Well, they certainly both produce a magnetic dipole, but to me there's a difference between a magnetic dipole that I think of as produced by orbital electronic motion around the boundary, even if that's closed, versus one I produce by canting an antiferromagnet.
I think that is a key difference is in this case, because your bulk is time-reversal invariant, so the Hall conducting is plus or minus 1/2 is determined by surface time-reversal symmetry breaking. So you can easily choose if you get then you do time-reversal, you get minus 1/2. So that means if you make a domain wall, you can measure really a transport current, which carries Hall conducting 1. But in this cross.
I mean, it's probably easiest to think about just some theta that is not 0 or pi, where you know it's gapped. You don't need to really worry about the surface. If the surface is weak, everything is already specified. But I think. They'll both be the same if you do some kind of measurement. Like, the reason why I brought up this CR203 experiment is that it does indicate that you might be able to measure theta in this kind of way. But the physical, I don't mean to say that the physical microscopic mechanism is the same.
But I guess what I'm saying is that if you can measure the 1/2 current, okay, then you could equally measure, in the same way, you could measure the current that Leon was asking about. Okay. Because it's not a transport.
But I guess I can think of experiments where if you could resolve somehow our thought experiments are one of them is sort of it's not a transport current, that's true, but one of them is electrons moving around the boundary and the other is spins.
How are you measuring?
Suppose you have an electron microscope that can pick out, you know, so what you're saying is you think there's no way to distinguish between an orbital, what I would call an orbital magnetic moment. There are two kinds, they're both not transport currents. One is, I would say, an orbital magnetic moment, and the other is a bulk spin magnetic moment. And you think those are indistinguishable. I could say that, you know, if you take a current loop, that produces a dipole. If I take a bar magnet, that produces a dipole. But I can look at them and tell that they're different. I mean, it's true they both produce dipoles, but that doesn't mean that they're exactly indistinguishable.
So my question is, what experiment is
that? Yeah, that is a good question, and that I don't know.
I think the only way you can distinguish is in one case you can make a domain wall.
Right, okay, but then you're not going to measure a half, you're going to measure one.
Yeah, exactly. But on the other side, in that magnetic material, you cannot get one and not two.
I agree. You can measure one. You can measure one with a transport experiment. But you can't measure a half.
But this also.
Well, okay. Well, but if you're asking how could I see a half, I mean, I think I can see a half in optical conductivity. I mean, in principle, that is, if I had an integer quantum Hall layer, I could see that sigma xy is equal to 1, e squared over h. That's fine. If I shine, the idea would be that, suppose I've got this surface layer, and it's well separated from the other surface. So I've got e squared over 2h minus e squared over 2h. And I put circularly polarized light, and the penetration depth of the light in the material is such that it doesn't make it to the bottom surface. And I do Kerr rotation. Then I'll see, I think I brought this up before, and you said I won't measure 1 part in 10 to the ninth, which is definitely true, but I think I'll be able to tell a difference. I should be able to estimate the magnitude of sigma xy by doing low-frequency optics.
So would that work for Leon's?
You mean in this chromium 203? Yeah. I suspect it probably wouldn't. It just seems like, there would be a difference because I would put it that the
difference away the
it's different in where the dipole moment is coming from, I guess. One of them, it really is surface conduction, and the other, it's you're canting a bulk antiferromagnet.
No, but it's the same effect. It's the same effect of action you're writing down, right? Yeah. The theta term. So why?
But if I think about an actual experiment, you know, the light is probing some particular depth of the sample. So it's like, for example, it seems to me that the response I'd get in the surface case won't depend on the exact penetration depth of the light, while the response I get if it's coming from the bulk will depend on the exact penetration depth of the light. So you know, it just seems like I can come up with probes that will probe either.
Even for the magnet case, the current is still not confined on the bond, so you have a finite depth.
Well, I mean, I would say that if I make this, suppose I make a bunch of little loop currents, this produces a magnetic dipole moment. Actually, there is some discussion in the Vanderbilt type of community about how circular dichroism and magnetic moment measure slightly different combinations of this kind of current and that kind of current. You could say that they're exactly the same, but I don't think that they're totally indistinguishable, because one is basically macroscopic and the other is not.
Joe, sorry, could you write that further down that side of the board?
Okay. The idea is, I would say that the chromium 203 situation would be analogous to having a bunch of little current loops that give me a magnetic moment. The other situation, the topological insulator situation, would be analogous to this. It's a macroscopic surface current. Is that visible still? Or?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I think Chaitin is the farthest one there.
What do you say about the current P waves? I mean, you can do it either way.
Oh, but that doesn't... So you're saying that... But I guess I just find it surprising that there's no way that I could... If the claim that if the statement is that it's difficult to distinguish in practice, I would say that it's probably difficult to distinguish in practice. Certainly, if you measure the bulk moment, these are exactly the same. If you're saying it's different in principle, it seems to me that there is a difference between a macroscopic, even though neither one of these is transport. Anyway, it may be. For example, if I took a picture with a microscope, it seems like I could tell the difference between the two, but maybe that's not right.
Yeah, basically, if you do any measurement which based on the Maxwell equation, then they are the same.
Exactly. I'd say anything that is purely the Maxwell equation and no microscopics probably is the same. I don't think that's anything that's macroscopic Maxwell. I think that microscopically...
So the curve rotation, for example.
That's not... I wouldn't necessarily characterize that as only macroscopic. Anyway.
Okay, so physically, the difference is still... In one case, the hot hand is due to surface, so that you can easily make a domain wall by the split on magnetic. But in the other case, you cannot do that.
Yeah, but then I can.
Yeah, I can. The domain wall is.
But I can measure. I can choose to measure just the surface or to measure the bulk. I mean, it's not true that every measurement has to measure the entire thing at once. So, for example, optical conductivity, you only measure some depth. That I suspect would be enough to distinguish, but maybe not.
I think even the main walls will not help, because the main wall can help if you are able to create a unit Hall conductance
right.
On the domain wall.
Right.
But if your material is, say, theta equals 110, and you may have a hard time to create strong domain walls to create unit Hall conductance.
That's right. It'd be hard to go from 1/10 to 9/10. Yeah.
Yeah, but for theta equals to pi.
Yeah.
But all domain walls for any theta will be integer valued. I mean, you'll get some multiple of v squared over h. That's invariant on the microscopic origin, I think.
Suppose in a periodic 3D sample with all the three direction periodic bound condition. So can I measure the theta?
Yeah, the idea would be apply a magnetic field and measure the polarization. So polarization, the fractional part of polarization, which is exactly what you want, is a bulk property. It's basically integral of A. So I measure the change in the integral of A as a result of applying an orbital magnetic field. Now, the one caveat is that you'll want to take a large enough supercell that you can get to the limit delta P by delta B. But yeah, I mean, the reason why I think that this magnetoelectric polarizability is actually, if you want to look for topological insulators in interacting systems like CR203, you don't want to have to build a giant thing and put a boundary on. That's not numerically feasible. This is saying that with a couple of unit cells, so for example, this calculation we did is just something like, I think the most we did was 20 unit cells, but this is exactly the calculation I described to you, and this will work in the interacting case. This is measuring, I believe, P, in an applied orbital field, and you can see that if you draw a slope to that, this gives you exactly the slope that you get from calculating theta from the Chern-Simons integral. So I think that this is, if you like, a perfectly good operational way to compute theta and tell if you have an ordinary topological insulator in an interacting system. It's not the first, but it works, I think.
But we don't have a proof then in the interacting system. I mean, we do have a well-defined...
This is the proof. I mean, it's a proof at least, yeah.
But this relies, I guess, there's some gap. I mean,
yes, I'm applying the magnetic field and not producing a gap. If I have an insulator and a large enough sample, I think that's probably a reasonable assumption.
If you measure the polarizability, that gives you theta, and if theta is phi, then you say it's a many-body system with a... No, but I guess the question is there a protection to that? So there is this argument...
That's the thing about if you're in the small b limit, dp dB will have to go to either 0 or pi in the right units if your initial system was time-reversal invariant.
Great.
And pi is the same as minus pi because of this polarization ambiguity that's always there.
So the claim is that there would be a phase transition for these two values, which seems reasonable, that between 0 and pi it cannot jump.
Unless you break time reversal, that's right. Which would be, if it happens spontaneously, which would be a phase transition.
But that's...
Okay, I think we should close the session. So the next speaker is Shinsei Ryu from Berkeley, and he's going to talk about the application of optical insulators in supercritical.
I don't want high tech. Thanks. Hello everyone. So I'm the third guy from Berkeley. So I'm Shinsei Ryu, and I'd like to thank collaborators and organizers who are all here. So I'd like to speak about the classification of topological insulators and superconductors. So I don't think I need any more introduction. So I ask my question right away. So how many different fermionic topological band insulating band structure are there in nature? So by topological, I mean roughly the following things. So if my state is topological, it must support a gapless boundary state if I make a boundary, like this picture. And the stability of the boundary state, gapless nature of the boundary state can be protected by some, possibly with some discrete symmetries. And as a corollary of the existence of boundary mode, we have a topological distinction of quantum ground state. Namely, if I have a state with a boundary state, and if I have another state without a boundary mode, I cannot connect these states adiabatically. So there's a topological distinction, which I pictorically draw this picture. So this circle is supposed to represent a collection of all quantum ground state. And if there is a topological distinction in quantum ground state, I cannot connect a ground state in this sector with another ground state in the sector without going through a quantum phase transition, because its boundary state cannot disappear suddenly. And because I have a topological distinction between different quantum ground state, I might label these quantum ground state by some integer, like Z2 integer or sigma xy. So this is the Z2 case where I have only two sectors. here I have an integer case, like integer quantum Hall effect, where I have integer classification. So of course, we all know several examples of topological insulators, like integer quantum Hall and Z2 topological insulators. And my question today is there any such topological band structures? So we remember that the time reversal symmetry is essential for Z2 topological insulators. So I'd like to start by first classifying possible discrete symmetry in nature. So since I'm talking about something topological, so I want to adiabatically change before my state. But then I impose discrete symmetries. And in my talk, I don't want to limit myself to the case where my deformation is limited by spatial symmetries, like discrete rotations or inversion symmetry, because it is too limited to my purpose. So from this point of view, the discrete symmetry I want to talk about is not related to spatial discrete symmetries. So at this point, we realize that the discrete symmetries which are useful to me is the discrete symmetries which are discussed in the context of disordered systems, because where I don't have any spatial symmetries. So actually, there is a natural framework to classify all these discrete symmetries. It is the random matrix theory framework. And there, in this context of random matrix theory, we speak about these types of discrete symmetries where I listed here. So one is time reversal symmetry, and the other is particle Hall symmetry, which might arise in describing the quasi-particles in Bogoliubov of Dujan Hamiltonian in superconductivity. So here, I distinguish three cases: the case without time reversal symmetry, and this I also consider a time reversal symmetry where T squared to be plus one. So this matrix has this structure, and the operation, when I apply my time reversal symmetry operation twice, I get one. The other case is, of course, the time reversal symmetry for electrons, where when I square my time reversal symmetry operation, I get minus one. So this symbol, this matrix appearing here satisfies this condition. Similarly, in particle Hall symmetry, we also distinguish three cases. One is a case without any particle Hall symmetry. And similarly to time reversal symmetry, I distinguish these two cases where the particle Hall symmetry matrix appearing here has different sort of signature. So later it will be very important that if I combine these two symmetries, I get another symmetry where my Hamiltonian, when sandwiched by these two operations, it flips a sign. Now, from this list of discrete symmetries, we can ask how many symmetry classes are there. I have three here, and I have another three here, so we immediately get nine possibilities, which I listed as a table here. So I have nine, actually plus one, because So first, for each possibility of time reversal symmetry, 0 plus 1 minus 1, and particle symmetry, 0 plus 1 minus 1, I get 9. But it turns out this SRS means the combination of time reversal symmetry and the particle symmetry. So we get immediately 1, 9, and whenever I have both symmetries, I automatically get this symmetry. But it turns out there's one extra symmetry class where I don't have neither time reversal symmetry nor particle symmetry, but I still get this third symmetry. That's why I get 10 symmetry classes. Now, probably I don't have much time to go into details for each classes, but I just want to say here we have three symmetry classes well known in the context of a disordered matter. It's orthogonal, symplectic, and unitary. And there, I have six different classes here, and let's see. five out of these, seven. five out of seven classes, we can interpret as a Bogori of the Jan Hamiltonians. Now we immediately realize that integer quantum Hall effect is in this unitary class, Hamiltonian, without any constraint. So integer quantum Hall effect in two dimensions is a topological insulator in this class. And these two topological insulators in three and two dimensions are in this symplectic class. So there is an obvious question to ask. Is there any other topological insulators in or superconductors in other symmetric classes? That is the question I want to ask today. And okay, here is the result. So these hashed regions, they represent a class which admits the topological distinction of quantum ground state. So for these three, I have a topological insulator of integer type. So it's H3, D3, C1. They all represent time reversal symmetric superconductivity. And I have additional two classes which admit D2 distinction of topological insulator. So I have five. This is the number which I have to remember. It's like there's the five string series in 10 dimensions. And there's five. It's a very good to remember. So now, how do we get this? So there are two underlying strategies we used to get this result. So one is this this sort of try and error approach. So if I discover a topological integer which we can label a quantum ground state, and if we can make sure that this invariant doesn't change for arbitrary deformation, we are done, because it cannot change under deformation. So this is the invariant. This is this is very similar to TKNN integer in two dimension, but we have now a three dimensional version of it, and I will explain this expression later. Another strategy which we also used extensively is the sort of this non-correspondence between bulk and boundaries, because usually topological insulator, as I proposed in the beginning of the talk, topological bulk admits non-trivial boundary, and the opposite is also true. If you find non-trivial state, like single Dirac fermion, it sort of implies that it is actually comes from the non-trivial bulk. So this is the second strategy I make use of. But let me first explain what this integer means. So I want to take a moment to review how we understand the two-dimensional integer quantum effect. So here, essential idea is that we take a translational invariant system just for simplicity, and then we have a band structure, and so I have many bands. Some of them are empty. I have a filled band here, and I have a band gap. And at each k, we have a bunch of collection of Bloch state. And the essential idea is that this collection of Bloch state can be understood as a map from Brillouin zone to some target manifold, which Joel also talked about. So for fermionic Hamiltonians without any discrete symmetries, the map which are relevant to us is this map. It's a two-dimensional, three-dimensional, or d-dimensional Brillouin zone, and the Bloch states define a map into this manifold. M is the number of filled or empty bands. N is the number of empty and filled bands. Now, mathematicians, they can tell me how we can classify these maps. And it turns out, if you just look at the math textbook, it tells me if the Brillouin zone is two-dimensional, this map, there's a topological distinction for these maps. So this is the mathematical notation. I don't explain it, but it's Z. So this Z just means there's the integer classification in two dimension, and which is the underlying reason why we have integer quantum Hall effect in two dimensions. Now let's go to three dimensions. And here, I look at, because since there's no three-dimensional integer quantum Hall effect, I have to look at different symmetry class. And there, I make use of this symmetry, which is the symmetry I explained before. It's a combination of time reversal and particle Hall symmetry. And if you don't remember, there are five symmetry classes which actually has have this symmetry. Now, for all these symmetry classes, the object I should look at has this block of diagonal structure. This is the collection of block of state at given k, but because of this symmetry, I can make this matrix into this off-diagonal form. Now, previously, this q is an element of so-called Grassmannian, which is this. But once I impose this symmetry, each of these block is just a unitary matrix. So now we have to classify the map, which takes point in Brillouin zone into some point in the unitary matrix. Again, I can just use math textbook, and it tells me that if the Brillouin zone is three-dimensional, there's a topological distinction which is classified by integer. And this integer is just the just labeled different topological class. Now, to get so for S3, this is the end of the story, but for other classes, I have more discrete symmetries, and what they can do, what these discrete symmetry can do is to limit the possible values for this integer, which probably I will just skip because it's more involved. But let me explain the second strategy to get five types of topological insulators. So now we look for the property of the boundary state. Now, as we know from integer quantum Hall effect and the Z2 topological insulators, there's something special going on at the boundary. Namely, if the bulk is topological, there's no way you can stop, but you can stop these boundary modes to conduct any impurities, any potential, any mass term. You don't open up a gap, or you don't localize your surface state. So we reverse the logic. We look for the for each class. We look for the Anderson localization problem, and we ask, can we get stable Anderson delocalization? And for these five classes, we found exactly that there's no way for these five classes we can localize the surface mode. On the other hand, for all the other five classes, there's a way to localize the surface modes or boundary modes. So from this, we conclude that by combining these two strategies, we conclude that in three dimensions, all these five classes admit topological distinction of ground state.
What is WZW?
This is the So these are the technology I didn't explain to you. So to describe Anderson localization or Anderson delocalization, we can make use of so-called nonlinear sigma model type approach, where you describe electron diffusion in terms of nonlinear sigma model with this target manifold, and these target manifolds allows some special terms, and the Wessel-Zumino-Witten term is the Wessel-Zumino-Witten term for this nonlinear sigma model, and because of this term, I cannot localize my electrons. And the same is true for these Z2 topological terms, which Akira Furusaki described on Tuesday.
So can you say anything when you don't have the chiral symmetry?
For all these cases, we don't have chiral symmetries, and I can always localize the
so that's what you can say. But in terms of the writing down the bulk,
mm-hmm. Right.
That's something that you're only able to do.
Yeah, exactly. I go back to this this one. So if I don't have chiral symmetry, first thing I have to do is to look for this map. And in three dimensions, there's no topological distinction. That is why I don't have a truly three-dimensional topological.
So you can't use this analysis
exactly
to get the Z2 invariant for the topological.
Exactly, right.
Actually,
it's somehow you have this winding number formula in 3D.
Right, right.
And that's for the chirosymmetric case, but it seems in general, maybe if we take our transaminase term, right, right, and reduce it to the chirosymmetric case, it will give you.
No. Oh, yeah, that I agree, I think.
Because it's likely the chirosymmetry requires your gauge field to have zero curvature so that the gauge connection is a pure gauge. So in that
right.
case,
yeah, exactly. That is the case. And I have another comment to get D2. D2, I mean, the combination of particle hole and time-loss asymmetry makes my life easier because I can now go back to K.
Right.
But if you have just only have time-loss asymmetry of particle hole, K and minus K are related, so then I have to change this
exactly.
Brilliant. It's a kind of OB fold. Right,
so
it's like OB fold, so it's like because of OB fold, I have two distinct things. Right? But, you know, I'm talking about a much simpler case. So now maybe examples are more interesting. So three-dimensional, is there any, I gave you a list, so is there any interesting example of topological insulators or superconductors other than bismuth antimony? And it turns out helium-3B, B is a topological insulator in the sense that I have a non-vanishing winding number that I defined before, and there's the surface Majorana fermion mode, which we cannot localize. But probably there will be more talks in the later part of this workshop, so I skip this. And there's an interesting topological insulator in the sense that all the other topological insulator we have been talked about in this workshop break spin rotation symmetry. But there's a singlet superconductivity which admits topological distinction. So it's there's the in terms of classification, it is a class C1. It is a ensemble of time-loss asymmetric singlet superconductivity.
And the topological superconductor, not
yes. It's not necessarily topological superconductor, but we are constructing topological superconductor with vanishing non-vanishing winding number, right? So because this class admits the topological insulator, we look for the some model which actually give rise to non-vanishing topological integer. There, this is the model. So I have a diamond lattice, nearest neighbor hopping, and next nearest neighbor hopping, and I put some D-wave-like pairing potential here. And I also put Stagger chemical potential. So I have four parameters, but if I just take nearest neighbor and this D-wave-like pairing symmetry, I create Dirac fermions at the corners of Brillouin zone. And with further changing nearest neighbor hopping and the Stagger chemical potential, I can give a mass to these Dirac fermions, which give rise to non-zero value of this winding number. And there I have a global phase diagram. So this is the Dirac point. And I can further tune several parameters in my lattice BCS Hamiltonian. And this, depending on these parameters, I get nu plus minus 2 or nu exactly 0.
So is this gapless without the Stagger chemical potential?
Maybe no. this is not gapless phase. This is the...
I'm asking you, so if you turn off the chemical potential and just keep the D-wave pairing, is it gapless
right.
or gap?
Stagger chemical potential.
Okay, so maybe I'm confused about what you're plotting in the space diagram.
Right, so this region, it's completely gap.
You said Stagger chemical potential.
Yeah, it's a Stagger chemical potential. So even if Stagger chemical potential is a zero, if T prime is non-zero, it is gap.
Okay, so if T prime is zero and μs is zero,
right? Yeah, it's gapless. This is
gapless pairing, and the pairing is not going to pull gap across the.
Yeah, it's a Dirac point.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for this phase, you just need to make sure the spin rotation symmetry, if I put disorder or something like that into this phase, as your spin rotation symmetry is stable.
Spin rotation with interactions, you mean?
No, let's say I put in disorder. Okay, my question is the following. You assume some sort of chiral symmetry here.
Right.
But that's the intrinsic Bogoliubov Duchenne particle.
But with time reversal symmetry, with SU2 and time reversal symmetry, you get the chiral symmetry. So here's the picture of surface mode. So we have a surface Boolean zone, and whenever I'm in the non-topological phase, I see these crossings, which is a nice fermion. But actually, these surface fermions always come in pairs. So that means surface is I have two Dirac cones, so it's like in terms of symmetry, this is like a one half of a cubelet, just like bismuth, the surface of bismuth antimony is a one half of graphene. So this is the nice, and with disorder, actually, as I said before, I can't localize this surface mode, and there's even the exact solution that available for this surface Dirac fermion mode with disorder. So let me wrap up. So we found five types of topological instrument out of 10 symmetric classes. And we used this correspondence between surface mode, non-trivial surface mode, and non-trivial bulk. And the same strategy, see here's for three dimension, and the same strategy is kind of applicable. So we always look at Anderson localization problem one dimension less. Then we can make a list. So so this is the list I talked about before, but it also applies to other dimensions too. Let me just superimpose what is known about these known examples of topological insulators. So integer quantum Hall effect is here, D2 topological insulator is here, quantum spin Hall effect is a topological insulator in the symplectic class, M3B is here, and I just discussed class C1 topological insulator, it's here. And there is obvious question, do we have physical realization for all these entries? Which is a very interesting question, but I think I leave it for the future. And once we get, suppose we have a candidate for this topological state, the experiment can be maybe some surface experiment, looking at the density of state at surface, or if possible, I would propose to look at some transport experiment, but as Jory said, maybe it's difficult. But since this is the beta graphene, maybe it is very interesting to ask this question. And finally, this is again the question asked by Ashwin and Joel, is there any topological physical description for this question? And for Micro, this is the last comment. And since this is a discussion, I can be murky, I think. So for my class, class C1, SU2 symmetry is preserved. So we measure SU2 current. So it's like we measure U1 current in the topological insulators. But now we measure SU2 current, so we couple SU2 gauge field. Now, a very naive guess is I get a theta term in SU2 gauge field. So then I can make instantons, I think. So that is the end of my talk. Thank you for your attention.
Part of the analysis was this trying to show the absence of localization for the surface states. Can you elaborate on how that's done? Don't elaborate very long. Saying how it's done.
Yeah, that's because basically this is the 10-year summary of history of Anderson localization. So it takes too long if I elaborate all this. So for all these classes, you have an exact solution. And you can show there's no localization for these three. And for A2, we know there is the it's a bismuth surface of bismuth antimony, and then we discuss this topological term, and we compute the beta function numerically. And here, again, this is the known class because of chiral symmetry. You can't localize your state. And in addition to that, there is the this little topological term. which cannot appear in the bulk. That is the free. So it's a mixture of many approaches. Sometimes we use nonlinear second-order description. Sometimes we use exact result. And for lower dimensions, they're much better method than this Hirschhorn method.
For instance, for nonlinear sigma model, you
right.
To regularize it in some way to say something about strong coupling.
No, I think only the existence of these terms are pretty good diagonalistics, because usually we don't know how to deal with interacting pair series. So
one only determines that there exists a term, and
right.
that's the.
That's pretty much it.
Of the calculation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
In cases where you don't use nonlinear sigma model, you.
In lower dimension, like. You take surface mode, which is Dirac fermions, and you input arbitrary.
Like Svelix thing.
Yeah, that's what. Exactly. But again, nonlinear sigma model approach is also applicable because you see some difference because the presence of these abnormal terms. But I'm just saying there's a better way to do it.
Yeah, I just wonder how really conclusive that kind of reasoning is. Everything is sort of based on some continuum field theory ultimately, and whether strong disorder is necessarily captured in there.
When you have the words, these exact solutions, do they tell you about this strong coupling fixed point?
Right, right.
They do?
Right, yeah. I mean, this solution is a prize for very strong, infinitely strong. Right.
No, but I should say, these are well-studied problems in the history of 15 years, and a lot of it is known, and we're just harvesting this history and the results. And that's just summarized here. Right? There's tons of approaches, tons of ways of thinking about it.
Because if you try to ask the regularization, maybe best regularization is just put this on the surface.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Then you always ask disorder must be weak enough without closing this gap and so on. But
then one is just making some circular argument.
Maybe I missed this. So for the 2D constraint, the form of the topological invariant.
2D. I didn't construct it. I think it is charged.
Yeah, but in your formalism, uh-huh. You have something like a winding number formula in that.
Yeah,
even if
right. Yeah, it's 3 dimension. It's a constraint dimension.
It's 3D, but I want to cover.
In two-dimensional quantum spin Hall effect. That was done by Doi, Lahoud, and.
I understand, yeah, but huh? I try to say what's the correspondence of your winding number formula in 2D.
Right.
Yes.
It's a 3D winding, so if you change dimensionality, it doesn't work.
But somehow it's become something like a white semi-Lewisian.
Oh, you wanna extend it?
Yeah, right. It becomes a property on the surface. That's my feeling because in 3D we have the P3 formula. Of
right.
What's the one dimensional topological the one dimensional edge state theory? What's the topological term?
For one dimensional, it's pretty much the same. It's just a new. B, Q, Q. Yeah, this is the formula. In 3D, you get 3, and for one-dimensional cases, we have the similar invariant. And actually, I don't extend this to 2D. For Z2, I mean.
For Z2, the formula simply doesn't apply because you don't have phi 2 is 0, right? That's what you.
Yeah, but. There's a way to extend it in higher dimensions.
I believe you'll have something like a Western.
Yeah, I think similar trick works for class C too. Maybe we can talk about this.
Any more questions?
So Leo, maybe you can say it again, where this afternoon starts and whatever.
2 o'clock in the main seminar room.
That's the big,
where the party was, in the orientation, yeah. It's divided into two rooms, a bigger one.
Go ahead.
Okay, let's thank Shinsei.